We're getting towards the end of Ephesians now, obviously, and we're turning to the more practical teaching. I guess you spotted that over the last few weeks. Today we're actually going to focus mostly just on verses 1 to 4, partly because there's a lot in there, and partly because when we did our series on what it means to be a Christian in the real world, we spent a bit of time, in fact a whole week, on the second passage, or at least its equivalent in Colossians. So really focusing in on basically on family, on children and parents. There's been a lot of talk about parenting over the last few weeks, with the riots in particular, and a lot of talk, a lot of questions asked, often, where are the parents? Many of the rioters were teenagers, and politicians and churchmen and journalists would all come on the TV programmes and ask, where are the parents? I was particularly struck by something Ed Miliband said, where he said, have we lost the ability to teach right and wrong nowadays? Do we never teach right and wrong to our children? Why do they not think in these kind of concepts? It's an interesting question, isn't it? But I probably want to ask back, well, who says what's right and wrong? It's okay for politicians to stand up and say we must teach right and wrong, but if in the same breath they're denying that you need to believe the Bible, or you need to believe in a God who puts down absolutes, right and wrong, well, why should we say anything is right and wrong? If it's simply survival of the fittest, and you can get through a shop window and pinch some clothes that you don't have to pay for, well, why not? Why not? If you're going to get away with it, and it's a dog-eat-dog world. It's all very well asking for morality, but if there's no basis for it, why should anyone listen to you? And yet somehow it's parents that are, at least in part, getting the blame for this rioting. And to a certain extent, I think that's right. The Bible's understanding of parents is not just that they're the ones who produce children and then kind of let the children grow up as they will. Now, the parents are very much responsible for every step in the child's journey. And what Paul does in this passage is deal with both directions of that relationship, as it were. First of all, from the children, looking upwards, how should children act towards their parents? And then from, well, parents, downwards, if I can put it that way. So first and more quickly, we'll look at children. And fairly obviously down in verse 1 there, the command is to obey your parents. Children, obey your parents. Now, when you look at different commentaries on Ephesians, one of the first things that almost everyone notes is that the sort of implication of Paul having written children, obey your parents, is that children would have been in the congregation to hear that. The way these letters like Romans and Galatians and Ephesians worked was they were sent round to different churches and read out. Obviously, to begin with, they didn't have the whole New Testament. They only had the parts written to them. You had Ephesians if you lived in Ephesus. You had Romans if you lived in Rome. And so these letters would be read in the churches. And clearly, Paul would expect children to be listening. He doesn't say, parents, tell your children to obey you. He addresses the children directly. Nowadays, in fact, really pretty recently, last 100 years, we've got into the habit of Sunday schools where just before the minister stands up, all the children rush for the door and the adults look on longingly. There are obviously positives to Sunday schools, lots of good reasons for it. But we must be training our children to be able to come to a normal church service. At what age that happens, I guess more or less, is up to the individual parents. But at some point, children need to learn how to listen to a sermon and need to understand what communion is, need to be part of the corporate worship of the church. And at Duffield, most of my time really was spent on youth work. And I was trying to think this week if there were any of the teenagers who came through the youth work who, having only attended youth group, kept going as Christians when they went off to university or work. Okay, so were any of them who just came to youth work and didn't come to church on Sunday still going as Christians? Now, it's quite possible I've missed one or something, but I couldn't think of a single one. Now, at times, our youth groups were as big as 30 kids, 30 14 to 18-year-olds and 30 11 to 14-year-olds. Perhaps 60, you know, in a big year, you might have 60 teenagers. And actually, I can't think of one who's still going, apart from the ones who got used to coming to church. Now, some of them came from Christian families, some of them came from non-Christian families. The key thing was, did they, at some point in their teenage years, get used to normal church? That is absolutely vital. If they grow up solely on sort of spoon-fed children's diet, sort of baby food, and then disappear out of your control after uni or work, then actually suddenly when they've got to eat a normal meal with everybody else, they're going to struggle. They must learn bit by bit. And their duty, well, their main duty to begin with is obedience, verse 1. Paul quotes the commandment, the fifth commandment, honour your father and mother. He understands that children are part of the church community. So he gives them the commandments which were given to the people of God. Remember, the Ten Commandments weren't just handed out to all the countries of the Middle East. They were given to the people who God had rescued. And the reason you were to obey them was you were part of that rescued people. Well, the children too are part of that rescued people. If you're a Christian and you've got children, they're part of the church community. They're not outsiders until they grow up and decide they want to join. They're in from the beginning. They're tremendously important to a church's life. Similarly, children in verse 1 are told to obey your parents in the Lord. Children are counted as in the Lord. We live in such an individualistic society that we get used to the idea that basically everybody is outside until you personally decide to join the church. It's each of our personal responsibilities. And of course, in terms of salvation, it is everybody's job to believe or not believe. But when you have children, as a Christian couple, or even just as one Christian parent, even if you're married to a non-Christian, they are counted as part of God's people. And so they should obey his commandments. Honour your father and mother and obey them. In fact, he even gives a reason, verse 3, which is, I think, quite surprising. You obey them that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. Again, he's quoting the Ten Commandments there. And it's a puzzling verse. It seems to be saying that if, as a child of Christian parents, you listen to your parents, you obey them more or less, you honour them, then actually, on the whole, life will go well, and on the whole, you will live a long time. Actually, that's exactly what it is saying. That's exactly what it is saying. Now, it's not an absolute rule. Okay, as soon as you read that kind of thing, you can think of, we could probably all think, tragically, of children, obedient children who've died young. And we can probably think even more of all sorts of ratbags who've lived to a great old age. But on the whole, it's true that if you are an obedient child, if you follow the ways of your parents who are Christians too, then you will live long and have a better life. And what that reminds us is that God's law isn't just a sort of arbitrary set of commandments that he wrote in heaven just to try and sort of split off the Christians from non-Christians, as if he just wanted to separate them for no good reason. So he wrote 10 really difficult rules and kind of lobbed them at Moses and said, there you go, give those to the people of Israel. Now he wrote them to show us how best to live. So to take a really obvious example, if you take the command we read earlier in Ephesians, not to get drunk, but instead be filled with the Spirit, seriously, well, on the whole, if you don't get drunk all the time, you're not ruining your liver or kidneys or whatever it is, you'll live longer. If, on the other hand, you're hammered every night, sloshing back the vodka, well, your life expectancy is going to drop. See, God's rules, all of God's rules, in fact, are for our good, for our blessing. And we should look at the commandments not as an oppressive thing, but as a setting free thing. It is just a better way to live, to obey God's rules. Of course there are exceptions, they're not absolutes. But, on the whole, children are to live in the manner of their parents. Of course that puts a lot of pressure on the parents. And actually the responsibilities of parents are enormous. And so for the rest of our time, really today, we're going to focus in on verse 4. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. The responsibilities on parents, or actually more specifically on fathers. Now, it's not a complete get-out if you're a mum. Of course you're responsible too for your children. But if you look down at that little passage, in verse 1, children are told to obey your parents. In verse 4, fathers are told to bring up their children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Verse 1 is parents, verse 4 is fathers. They are two different words. If Paul had wanted to say in verse 4, parents don't provoke your children, and parents bring them up in the discipline and fear of the Lord, he could have done. But he deliberately says fathers, different word. And that is because in the Bible's understanding of family, it is the father who is, as it were, the head of the family. It is the father who has responsibility. And again, we can instantly think of exceptions. Of course there are, when people are widowed, perhaps, or divorced, or all sorts of things can disrupt that pattern. But all things being equal, in a married couple, the father is the head of the family. Just as we saw last week, he's the covenant head. When the wife and husband marry, they, as it were, sign a pact, a treaty, an agreement to bind themselves together. And the husband, in God's economy, takes responsibility for the wife and for his children. And so that means straight away that it can never be the case that a dad looks at his children and say, why are you doing that? So take a dad whose daughter is constantly getting drunk, teenager, always out on the town, drinking too much. He is never just to sit there, point the finger and saying, how dare you do that? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? Why are you drinking so much? When he comes to pray for his daughter on his own, he's not just praying, Lord, I don't understand what she's doing. Change her, save her, turn her around. He doesn't talk in the me, you language. He talks in the we language. He is the head of that family. And so he prays to God, Lord, somehow we've gone wrong here. Lord, help us to help Sarah with her drink problem. Lord, this is my family that you've entrusted to me. Help me in this situation. We're to be for our children, take responsibility for them. It's not that they're never guilty of their own sin. Of course they are. The drunk teenager is still responsible for her sin. But the father is too, takes responsibility for his children. Fathers are the head of the family. If we don't like the idea as fathers or future fathers of being responsible for other people's sin, well, in a sense, we're saying we don't like the gospel. The whole message of the gospel is Christ, who is our covenant head, head of the church, takes responsibility ultimately for us, and he even pays for it in a way that we don't for others. Covenants enable sin to be transferred. And so as head of our families, in a way, we're being mini Christs, to put it, if I can put it like that, to the rest of our family. We take responsibility, even if, thankfully, we no longer have to pay the penalty. So it is to fathers, first and foremost, the instructions for children are given. And there's a negative and a positive. The negative, I guess, is fairly obvious. Do not provoke your children to anger. The idea of a father who is constantly crushing his kids. Why are you not getting better A-level results? Why are you not better behaved? Why do you not know the Bible better? Why have you not learnt your memory verses? Why are you being mean to your sister? Constantly piling on burden upon burden upon burden, crushing them, until actually the Bible just becomes, as it were, a dead weight on them. It's not a freeing book or a liberating book. It's like the sort of old school Bible. They're just absolutely burying them. And they're just exasperated. The father who only gives their children law upon law upon law, says Paul, is not giving them the right message. We're not to crush them, provoke them to anger. So then the massive disciplinarian is certainly not a good model of a Christian father. I think it's not reading too much into it either to say that neither is a father who's completely standoffish. And this maybe is more of our danger. I don't think, just sort of knowing most of you a little bit at least, I don't think there's many of you who are massively sort of aggressive, crushing down types. Maybe you're hiding it well. But I don't think so. Most of us, and I certainly include myself here, are just more slightly sort of laid back, chilled out types who basically don't want to take responsibility. The reason I think that's probably included here is because of the contrast. Do not provoke your children to anger. What's the contrast? It's not be gentle with them or forgive them lots. The contrast is instead bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. So the opposite of provoking them, being too heavy-handed, is teaching them. So if we're standing back and never intervening in their lives, actually we're probably also doing a bad job as parents. As part of a pastoral counselling course we had to do at Theological College, we came across the case of a girl who'd been brought up in at least a nominally Christian home, and in her teenage years had just started sleeping around. And her parents, and particularly her dad, had done nothing. So even when he was in the house and she knew she had a boy, sorry, he knew his daughter had a boy up in the bedroom, he would never butt in. He would never butt in. He would never butt in. And years later, she came to faith. And she started coming along to church. And eventually, she and her father had a sort of face-to-face. And this case was kind of recorded, and this is how we came across it. And she basically broke down and just said to her dad, all that time that I was disobeying you, all that time I was bringing boys into the house, and you did nothing, I was longing for you to knock on the door and break us up. I was desperate for you to intervene and tell me no. I was desperate for you to show enough that you cared. And the more you didn't, and the more you stood back and did nothing, the more outrageous I got to provoke you just to show that you cared about me. It was a massively striking story. I don't know what was going through the father's head, either when he heard years later, or at the time as he stood back. Perhaps he thought he was just saying, well, look, I've got to let her live a lone life. You know, who am I to butt in? But no, fathers, we're to protect our families from sin, from Satan, from pressures from the world. We must step in those kind of circumstances. Do not provoke your children. And it may be that actually it's your father who has been the person who's done most to undermine your belief in the gospel. So many of us have either had our picture of God as a father ruined because our dads have let us down one way or the other, been massively overbearing, even abusive, or just stood back and let us be. Or actually, they've claimed to be Christian and modelled things so badly that it's just made Christianity a joke in our eyes. Well, actually, to see what a real father is like, we can't look even to the best of human fathers. We've got to understand that all humans are sinners and look instead to the fatherhood of God. And if that is you and you are missing a real father, then actually God's offer to become his child is a great one. And it's only as we look at him that we see the real father in action. So, negatively, don't provoke your children, but there's a positive too. The positive is bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Again, it's the fathers who are responsible for this, first and foremost. Not mothers, not schools, not youth groups or churches. It's no use just saying, I hope the youth group or the creche or the kids' work will turn them into Christians. It's our job as fathers, and of course with the mothers. But what does it mean to bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord? Well, first and foremost, it means setting our minds right at the beginning. And in fact, for many of us, we haven't got children yet, so it means setting our minds on this before we even have children. What is the most important thing for my children? There's a book, a famous book written, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And the sort of principle there, the first principle was, you make a list of what you want to achieve that day or that week, and you prioritise it. And very simply, you start at number one, and you work downwards. Similarly with raising children, you make a list of what you want for them and start at number one with the most important and work down. Now, at number two, you might have succeed academically, get good GCSEs, even though they seem to be giving them away in crisp packets nowadays. Number three might be great sportsman or musician. Number four might be get married and have children. You must make sure that number one is the same as Jesus is number one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength. And in fact, make number two that they be the kind of children who love their neighbour as themselves. And the reason that's so important is because there is immense pressure on us to have all those other things up there as number one. And again, as a few years of youth work under the belt, this was by far the biggest problem. Well, it was joint biggest problem. I'll get to the other one in a minute. Very few parents, especially church parents that I've come across, were encouraging their children to say, hey, go out, why don't you try drugs? You know, try it and see if it works. Why don't you try sleeping around? Just see how it works. And then you can try a bit of Christianity and just make your own mind up. I don't think any of them ever said that. Far more common was the just implicit pressure to be a brilliant academic, to really invest in your dance class, to be grade 8 clarinet, to be able to ride a pony, or it was Duffield, so it's more sort of a different world, polo, whatever it was. And the pressure was there. And you see, these are good things, aren't they? They're all good things. They're not bad things. But because these good things were so time-consuming and so all-consuming, in fact, that actually God just began to drop down the list, and so he eventually disappeared off the bottom. And we had children who were brilliant academically, teenagers who were fantastically gifted at music and sport, but actually had no interest at all in God. Now you think of the parable of the wedding banquet, the host invites all sorts of different people, and they start making excuses. One says, "I've just got married. I'm sorry, I can't come." The next one says, I've just bought some oxen. I can't come. I've just bought a field. I'm going to go and look at it. See, none of them are rude things or bad things or kind of anti-Christian things. Nothing wrong with plowing fields. Nothing wrong with being married. They're just good things that have got away in the way of the most important thing. And in bringing up children, that is hugely easy to do. Perhaps grandparents want them to be academically brilliant or whatever. But we must stand firm. First and foremost, love the Lord your God with heart, soul, mind and strength. And it's not just a case of saying that to them or hoping that the youth group leader says that to them. We have to live it out. And actually, how we model it will be far more important, really, than what we say with our lips. Yes, there is a teaching responsibility there. So bring them up in the instruction of the Lord. We're to teach them as parents. And there are all sorts of resources to help you. If that just looks terrifying or sounds terrifying, there's loads of great things that can help. But actually, how we live, how you treat your wife, their mother, will teach them more about how to treat the opposite sex than any book or lesson at school. How you react to disaster, to getting ill, to losing your job, to being financially under trouble, will show them far more than anything you ever preach at them. Do you turn to God in prayer, or do you panic and shout and scream? When you're sinned against, do you forgive, or do you strike back? They will pick this up. We think of children as rocks, sort of hard little things, that more or less you can leave alone and they'll sort of be the same. Actually, they're like sponges. They will suck up something. They'll suck up gospel water if you model that to them. But if you don't, they'll just get their messages from Hollyoaks and EastEnders and everything else they're watching on TV. They'll pick up their beliefs about life from the world around them, from their schoolmates, from their teachers. They will suck something in. And it's either what you model at home or something much worse. So modelling is key. Richard Baxter, who was around in the 1600s, said this: few parents do their duty. Many take more pains about their horses and cattle than they do about their children. I don't suppose many people here have got horses and cattle, but is it true you take more concern about your computer, your new kitchen, your house, your holidays, your career, than you do your children? Will that be true for you in the future if the Lord blesses you with children? Resolve now that it won't be. And the positive continues. Bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Just very quickly on discipline, it is important. The world around us tells us that we're just animals. We just obey our instincts. So you can't really blame us for going one way or the other. But the Bible tells us differently, doesn't it? We have a soul, a spirit that knows right and wrong. And so when a child sins, when our own children sin, it's right that we discipline them. Time and again in the Bible, we're told that if we don't, then we're leading them into trouble. So in Proverbs, we're told, spare the rod and you spoil the child. Or later, do not withhold discipline from a child. If you strike him, he will not die. If you strike him, you'll save his soul from Sheol, from death. There is a place for discipline, and dare I say it, even physical discipline at times. Not out of disproportionate. You never lose your rag with your children, because that's not godly discipline, is it? God doesn't lash out at us when we sin, but he does discipline us. The Lord disciplines those he loves, we're told, in Hebrews. And so at times, discipline will have to be painful for our children. Either sort of generally painful, so they want to go out, they're not allowed. They've got to go and sit on the naughty step, whatever it might be. Sometimes it'll be physically painful. There's nothing wrong, I need to say. Biblically, certainly, it's encouraged for a short, sharp smack for a toddler who's disobedient. At some stage, that stops. But in the Bible, that is still a way of disciplining our children. And thankfully, in England, it's still legal, at least for now. So discipline is there, rebuking of sin. And it must, of course, be followed instantly by forgiveness. When we sin against the Lord, he forgives us straight away, doesn't he? And so too, as Christians, we must forgive our children, as I said, and not lash out. But there's also the instruction of the Lord. The words involved here are go far beyond just telling them a Bible story at night or giving them the odd sort of Sunday top-up after church. The words, in fact, both these words together, discipline and instruction, would bring to mind for an Ephesian, a Greek speaker, the whole process of, I suppose, enculturing your children, imparting to them a whole world view. So it's not just that we're to teach them about David and Goliath and Noah and the Ark. It's we're to teach them how to view society, how to view the world through Christian lens. Again, think back to that verse. Love the Lord your God with your heart, soul, mind and strength. Well, of course we teach them how to love God with our hearts. Okay, the importance of worshipping God. We teach them how to obey him. That's the sort of strength thing. We teach them right and wrong. We teach them to be soul believers, to pray, to have those spiritual disciplines. But also we teach them to love him with their mind. And this probably is the one that is getting increasingly hard, if we're honest, in the UK at the moment. Historically, most of the schools were founded by churches, by Christians, and there was a Christian education on offer. That's obviously hugely drifted over the last few years. In fact, even since some of us young ones were at school, there have been changes in the kind of curriculum. But somehow we have to prepare them for battle. Ephesians 6, the next passage, the whole armour of God, talks about the spiritual warfare that goes on. And one of the ways that children are most often, and teenagers, inoculated against the gospel is by going to school and having it told them time and time again that at best God is irrelevant. And again, this was the second thing that really struck me at Duffield. Very few came out of lessons having been told that God doesn't exist. But time and time again, they came out, and they would tend to be pretty smart kids in Duffield, they came out believing that God was irrelevant. You could go through life fine without him. If you wanted to add him on as a kind of spiritual thing, great. But actually the world makes sense without him. There are these things called the laws of nature that exist, and that's how the world works, rather than believing that God has established patterns that keep the world going. They were taught history that sort of pointed out all the abuses of the church, the terrible things the church has done, and how now we've put religion behind us, we can be at peace. A massive distortion of history. They were taught RE in a way that made all the religions just kind of look the same. And you pick and choose, it's up to you. Rather than telling them that there is one true God. And as I hope we saw last term when we looked at our series on culture and the world, there is no neutrality. Jesus doesn't say you can be for me or against me or kind of on the fence. It's for or against. Paul tells us that from Jesus and through Jesus and to Jesus are all things. Nothing makes sense without him. Everything that exists is for him. And actually, he holds through him. He holds everything that exists together. So you can't live in the world properly without being Christian. And it's education's job to push kids to being more Christian. Stalin said, education is a weapon whose effects depend on who holds it in his hands and at whom it's aimed. And Stalin, obviously, was aiming in a pretty bad way. But part of our training as fathers is to bring them up in a way that intellectually, in their minds, they won't be inoculated against the gospel, but will be pushed towards it more and more. Now, what does that look like? Well, that's going to be a big question over the next few years. I think increasingly, probably for Christians in the UK, it'd be great if there were more explicitly Christian schools around. But it will be a massive responsibility and one that should drive us to our knees in prayer, because it's also the one where the battle is going to be most beyond us in terms of our finances, in terms of our time and resources. So as we finish, children obey and fathers, bring your children up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. If there's one thing to pray for from these verses, it's actually that we believe and trust that the most important thing for our children is to know and love the Lord, to worship him heart, soul and strength. And if we're going to pass that on genuinely and not as hypocrites, then the most important thing is that we love the Lord heart, soul and strength, that we give ourselves to him above all else. And so the first place is to start is with personal repentance. We know our lives don't go as they should. We know we give ourselves to foreign gods, to idols. We know that we do push God into a kind of you can live in the attic attitude. I'll pull you down on a Sunday, but the rest of my life is fine without you. How does God treat those who do that? With grace and mercy and forgiveness. We're going to come now to the Lord's table, which is, as it were, a meal with God. And he invites sinners to it. It's a meal of refreshing, where we, having sinned all week, having lived as if we shouldn't be invited, we're told again we're invited in to begin again a new week on this first day of the week, trying to live for him. So again, we'll have just a moment's quiet, a confession, as we think back particularly over whether we've lived heart and soul for Jesus over the last week. I'll then read some words from Paul, and we'll share the bread and